This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
President Biden urges congressional action to prevent a U.S. rail shutdown. Plus, China's global infrastructure ambitions begin to run into resistance.
People in many places in the developing world, they have at times seen China as a sort of foreign interventionist or imperialist entity.
And the Vatican steers Catholics toward faith-consistent investments. It's Tuesday, November 29th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. President Biden is calling on the U.S. Congress to pass legislation to avert a railroad shutdown by imposing a proposed contract that members at four railroad unions had rejected. In a statement, Biden said he was reluctant to override those who'd voted against the labor deal, but added that a rail shutdown would hurt millions of other working people and families. Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House would vote this week on legislation to adopt the tentative agreement. Under the Railway Labor Act, Congress can make both sides accept an agreement that their members have voted down. Qatar has signed a small-scale agreement to supply Germany with natural gas as Berlin races to cover future needs following the rupture of its decades-long energy relationship with Russia. Qatar, one of the world's largest exporters of the fuel, has agreed to send Germany 2 million tons of liquefied natural gas a year for at least 15 years, starting from 2026. The agreement is the first long-term LNG deal that Qatar has signed with Europe. Private equity firm TPG has recruited former Wall Street power broker Tom Montag, who retired last year as chief operating officer at Bank of America, to launch a carbon credit business that it hopes will add transparency and boost growth in the nascent market for emissions offsets. TPG is investing $300 million into the new company called Rubicon Carbon and is aiming to raise a total of $1 billion to kickstart the effort. Wall Street Journal Deputy Europe Finance Editor Quinton Webb has more.
The market for voluntary carbon credits was a focus of the recent global climate summit that was held in Egypt. We should say that this is a largely unregulated market, and it has been criticized by some for inconsistent standards, for potential conflicts of interest. And there are question marks about whether in some cases it is genuinely helping to reduce the amount of carbon being emitted. Players on Wall Street see a chance to help define this nascent industry and to improve standards. And let's be honest, they also see an opportunity to profit as well.
And on the agenda today, the U.S. Supreme Court will consider a challenge to the executive branch's power to set priorities in enforcing immigration law. States have sued to invalidate guidelines to prioritize which immigrants illegally in the country should be deported. On Capitol Hill, meanwhile, chief executives of the two largest U.S. supermarket chains, Kroger and Albertsons, are set to testify before a Senate subcommittee. They are expected to defend their company's proposed $20 billion merger and address how it could affect American grocers and consumers. And in sports, the U.S. men's national soccer team will face off against Iran in a must-win match at the World Cup in Qatar. Kickoff is at 2 p.m. Eastern. We have talked before on this show about socially responsible investing, whether it's through an ESG framework or otherwise. And now the Vatican is getting involved, contributing its own framework for how Catholics around the world can make what it calls faith-consistent investments. It is the Church's highest-level effort so far to direct investments in accordance with Catholic teaching. And Wall Street Journal Vatican correspondent Frank Rocca in Rome joins us now with the details about this framework. Frank, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Luke. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So what are the Vatican's new investment criteria exactly, and what's the rationale behind doing this in the first place?
Well, you could say that they're a sort of Catholic ESG program. It's based on the principles of Catholic social teaching, such as human dignity, the common good, social justice, care for creation, that is the environment. And so with the result that there are a number of sectors that are under the so-called exclusionary criteria, which means that really people ought to be very careful about investing in these areas or not investing in them at all. So areas like fossil fuels, violent video games, drugs that induce abortion, also armaments, pornography, even genetically modified seeds, mining. They stress that these are voluntary, these are proposals, this is not an order coming down from Rome or from the Pope. But neither are they saying everybody needs to divest or to completely avoid these sectors, but they are suggesting that people act as activist investors and engage with management to try to move in what they consider to be a more positive direction, for example, in the energy area, to move toward renewable energy from fossil fuels, for example.
Frank, are investors likely to change their behavior in response to these guidelines?
Well, the most important audience to which these guidelines are addressed are Catholic institutions and organizations. And so the U.S. Bishops' Conference responded when we inquired and said that they would certainly take this as important input for the next time they revise their guidelines. And of course, an important target is the Vatican itself, because right now there are 10 people on trial in a Vatican courtroom on a series of charges, but it all stems from an investment in very costly London real estate that the Vatican said was culpably reckless. And one of the people who prepared these guidelines said that if the Vatican were to have followed these rules itself, that would never have happened.
And Frank, what might this all mean for companies if Catholic institutions do in fact end up reevaluating their investments in the future?
Well, I know that the University of Notre Dame, the premier Catholic university in the United States, has an endowment of billions of dollars. So that would be one indication of how much clout. If you put together dioceses, universities, hospitals, religious orders, we're certainly talking many billions of dollars in the U.S. alone.
That was Wall Street Journal Vatican correspondent Francis Rocca joining us from Rome. Frank, thank you so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Coming up, China's Belt and Road investment strategy is beginning to meet resistance in the developing world it seeks to influence. We'll get an update from Pakistan after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
China's Belt and Road Initiative has seen Beijing spend billions of dollars in countries all across the developing world in order to expand its influence in places as diverse as Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But along with that influence, Beijing is now being forced to contend with a host of problems in the countries where it operates, from corruption to political instability and violence. And Wall Street Journal correspondent Saeed Shah joins us now from Islamabad, Pakistan, with more on this trend. Saeed, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Could you tell us, first off, about some of the challenges emerging for China where you are in Pakistan, in spite of the quite expensive investments China has been making in that country?
Well, Pakistan was supposed to be a showcase for Belt and Road. It is a very, very close ally of China, and it actually shares a land border with China. So the idea was that Pakistan would demonstrate the success of Belt and Road, and primarily on the economic front, that these Belt and Road projects in Pakistan, which were started about 7 years ago, would lay the foundations for Pakistan's economic trajectory to change, and that there would be a sort of industrialization at last in Pakistan. Now, that hasn't panned out on the economic front. And in addition to that, China has encountered huge security problems here. I mean, China is operating in developing countries primarily with this program. And with that come all the problems that many of these developing countries face, including insurgencies, other violence, criminality, political instability, and corruption. And in Pakistan, China has found itself in the crosshairs of not one, but two different insurgencies. And so Chinese projects have been targeted, Chinese citizens have been targeted, and really for both Pakistan and China, this is excruciatingly embarrassing that here's a country which is supposed to be perhaps the closest in the world to China, and Chinese people are not feeling safe in Pakistan.
Saeed, are those challenges representative of issues that China is encountering across the broad global swath of Belt and Road Initiative projects?
Well, China has come up against the chaos and instability across the developing world in places like Iraq, in places like Nigeria. It is dealing with countries which by their nature are still evolving. And so one aspect of that has just been simple criminality and kidnapping, because these Chinese enterprises are often sort of richer than the surrounding population. So that's one obvious thing. But it is in Pakistan where it seems to have faced its most extreme challenge in terms of violent opposition by these insurgent groups. So it's not the population at large, but it is these very well organized insurgent groups. In some countries, for instance, in Central Asia, it has faced a more public backlash of interference in those countries, the controversial Chinese projects in those countries. And so there has been, in some countries, a more public opposition to China.
There's a lot of troubles for China, it sounds like, that you're detailing here, but they're still getting quite a bit from some of these projects, are they not?
Well, in the countries in which China is carrying out these projects, it is essentially lending money. So it is a commercial proposition. And then it is a way of spreading Chinese influence. And we should also say that for developing countries, often China is the only game in town. If they want big, shiny infrastructure, new railways, power plants, new ports, no one else has the firepower that China can provide them. So that is the attraction. One shouldn't lose sight of the fact that China is providing a service, that these countries are volunteering to have these Chinese projects.
And in terms of how Beijing is responding to all of this, Saeed, do they have a plan?
I think it is trying to evolve a strategy. In the case of Pakistan, it is reliant on the Pakistan army, essentially, to protect it, along with paramilitary and police. So it is dependent on the Pakistani authorities to provide that security. And in terms of numbers, the Pakistanis have provided more or less one soldier for every Chinese person here. That still hasn't worked. So they need better intelligence. They need better deployment of technology, such as face recognition and so on. In other countries along the Belt and Road, China is increasingly turning to its own private security companies. Now, of course, in China, private doesn't always mean private. I mean, these enterprises do have a close relationship to the Chinese state. They often are former Chinese military personnel. But these companies are being built up in order to provide security for Chinese citizens abroad and Chinese projects. And there are about 500,000 Chinese engaged in these projects to protect. So it's a big headache.
That was Wall Street Journal correspondent Saeed Shah joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Saeed, thank you.
It's great to be on.
And finally, as many of us continue to go about our holiday shopping, maybe you already know about the long-standing retail trick of using nines or 99s in prices in order to make shoppers think that something's a good deal. But what if it's not just that $9.99 isn't a better deal than $10, but that prices ending in 9 are outright bad deals? Research published last year from economists at Emory University and Israel's Bar Ilan University found that when prices in American grocery stores ended in 9, they were, on average, 18% higher than when those same items' prices had different endings. Wall Street Journal markets columnist Josh Zumbrun explains why 9s have retained their sway over shoppers.
I think a lot of consumers kind of know that $9.99 is the same as $10. It's just that when you're in the grocery store, you're buying 40, 50 different items sometimes, right? You don't have time to sit there and think, oh gosh, what did these eggs cost when I bought them 2 weeks ago, right? It's kind of overwhelming to do that. And so the people who study this see this in all sorts of product categories. They found it in cheese, crackers, bottled juices, canned soups, detergents, painkillers, cigarettes, toilet paper, like everything had this phenomenon where actually when it has a 99 cent price ending, that's when it's relatively expensive. And it was when it had all the other price endings that it was kind of a better than average bargain.
And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.